This is episode 4 of season 5 of The Bad Apples. Hi, my name is Klaatu, and this is my show about Linux and GNU and generic Unix with a lowercase u and geeky and techie topics. If you hear noises in the background on this episode, it's because I'm kind of standing out in the snow, actually, in about 3 or 4 feet of snow, it must be. I'm not actually knee-deep in it, but I'm here by the snow, and I'm just kind of enjoying the scenery. It's really, really beautiful here. I'm kind of out by a little bit of a wooded area, and it's just, you know, just naked trees with the snow on the branches and the snow on the ground. And in the distance, I see and hear cars, but you may or may not be hearing that. And it was just kind of amusing this week to see the world kind of coming to an involuntary stop, at least, you know, my little world, the area that I'm in, just coming into a complete involuntary stop because of all the snow. So it's kind of neat to see everyone taking an enforced vacation. So I'm just kind of enjoying the last portion of that before everyone starts cleaning up. Just a couple of days ago, the nearby highway was completely empty, and it was just so quiet. It was almost eerie. Anyway, in this episode, we're going to talk about foreign characters on your Linux keyboard. We'll talk about some listener feedback and probably a couple of other topics as well. So let's get started. So if you've been listening to my show for a little while, you'll know that I came from having used Mac OS my entire life. Apple computers all the way, hence the name of the show, actually, originally. But I don't do that anymore. But the Mac OS stuff, I kind of know really just by heart and almost muscle memory. So there aren't many Mac shortcuts or tips that I'm not aware of. And one of those that I used to use fairly often were the keyboard shortcuts to get foreign or non-American, for me, letters from my keyboard. So it's an American keyboard. There are no accented letters, for instance. No E with an accent over it. No A with no N with a tilde over it. You know, things like that. So in order to get those non-native characters is a keyboard combination. I don't know what this translates to over on Windows, but for me it was option and then whatever letter I wanted to affect. Sometimes there would be option, some other key, which would take me into the dead letter mode, and then some other letter that I want to affect. So that would mean that could be either one key combination or one key combination and then another key. And that was how you did it, and it was with the option key, and if you played around on the option key long enough, also called the alt key on modern keyboards, play around on that enough, and you find all kinds of interesting characters, like Inyes, that funky German letter that looks like a big capital B, but it makes the double S sound. I don't even know what the characters mean, or what it's called. The O with two dots over it, the C with a little mark under it, you know, from Eastern Europe, and just all kinds of different interesting characters. The all rights reserved, the copyright, the trademark, all those symbols. Yen, British pound, everything you can think of, it was accessible via the option key. Fast forward to, well, the recent past, and I've got Linux now on all my machines, and I have no idea how to make these foreign characters, no clue. So one way I found out how to do this was when I installed an Esperanto distribution, or it was Debian, and then I selected Esperanto as the character set and the language of the OS. So I had that running on a PowerPC for a little while, and in that case, the characters were simply, they were the Esperanto characters, and you didn't really have to think too much about it. There were still some things that you couldn't quite get to because they just didn't exist on the keyboard, some certain marks over a letter and things like that. And luckily, Esperanto takes this into account and has an interesting way of kind of like, if you don't have those keys available to you, then you can spell it this other way. So that was really, really clever and really cool that a language would think to work around keyboards, modern keyboards and stuff like that. But overall, it's kind of cool to have access to that. And it's a computer, you feel like you should be able to. So I would ask around a lot, and no one would ever be able to exactly tell me how to do this on a Linux keyboard, and I'll discuss that in a little while, but I would like to first and foremost discuss how to actually do that. So the way that it's done, the answer came via a wiki post, a wiki entry on Linux Questions. You probably know of Linux Questions as a forum, and a great forum that you can post a question and probably it's going to get answered. But they do have a wiki version of their site, a wiki portion of their site, and buried in an entry about keyboard configuration, there was this little tip, and I tried it and it works, and then I expanded it a little bit so that it would persist over time and stuff like that. So here's what you do, and this is really cool. So you go into your terminal, and you can type, well, first you need to find out what key you want to become the modifier key. So like I said, on Mac OS, it's option key, right? So on Linux, I mean, you could assign the alt key to be this magical modifier key, but if you do that, obviously that could interfere with other things, right? Because now you've got alt wanting to do, you know, alt, I don't know, F wanting to take you into the file menu of whatever application you're in, and so making your alt key the modifier key is pretty dangerous, I think. Well, what you could also do is do the Windows key, right? But this is also called, what is it? Well, in Fluxbox, it's mod 4, and I think in other applications, it's called the super key. The problem with assigning the Windows key to this is that, or at least for me, I have the super key bound to all kinds of things, both in Fluxbox and in KDE. So if I try to use that to enter text, I think that could interfere with a lot of my key bindings. Don't really want that. Luckily, on a PC keyboard, there's one other key that actually I've never used, and I have no idea what it's for, and it's got a little icon of a menu on it. Intuitively, I would imagine that was some kind of menu key, but I've actually never pressed it to find out. So I figured, well, you know what? If I've lived all this time without using it, I bet I can probably live forever not using it. I decided to make the menu key on the right-hand side of the keyboard my special magical modifier key, and there's a proper name for it, which I'll go into in a moment. I did this because, well, like I said, I don't want to interfere with other key bindings, but also because on my triple EPC, on my Lenovo, and on my Toshiba, there is this little menu key. And so I feel pretty confident that it's going to be on all the PCs. I mean, I've never really noticed if they're on every PC, but I have noticed, like I say, that on the three PCs that I own, it is on there. So I'm assuming it's probably a pretty standard. Oh, and one at work. It's on a Lenovo keyboard at work. So that's four PCs out of five that I've owned, and I think the fifth one had it, but I don't remember now, and I can't verify. So what I did was, well, what you have to do is find out what that menu key, the key code of that is. And a key code is some number, and I don't know how it gets assigned, but it's a number that essentially the keyboard sends to the operating system to say, hey, I've been pressed. If you fire up a little program called Zev, X-E-V, which is also the name of the main character on an obscure sci-fi series, extra credit if you know which one I'm talking about. So you press, you enter Zev, and then you'll notice that your terminal starts spitting back things at you, notably information on any other key that you press. If you press the letter A, it will give you this big block of text about, okay, here's all the data, here's how long you pressed it, here's what you pressed, here's when you pressed it, just all kinds of data about that. So if you hit the menu key while Zev is running, you will see data about that key event. And the thing that you are looking for is called a key code, and it is in that block of text. And if you just press the menu key and then look, you will see something. I think it's, well, you could even grep for the key code. I mean, if you do Zev and then pipe that to grep for, you know, grep key code, then you'll only get the key code practically. You'll get the line that the key code is on. So key code, and then on my computers, all the computers that I've done this on so far, so that's four, it's key code 135. Okay, now we know the key code. So now you can close Zev, and the way you do that is you close a little pop-up window that it opened up, because obviously if you press other keys, it continues to run and just tell you happily what key combination you pressed. You don't want that. You want it to close. So close the little pop-up window that's opened up for you, and that kills Zev. And then you have the key code right in your head, so it's key code 135. Now, if we run a little application called xmodmap, that is xmodmap. That's all one word. It's all lowercase. If we run that, it's going to do things to our keyboard, and we can define exactly what it's going to do to our keyboard, and specifically we can say, okay, we want xmod map space dash e space double quote key code space 135 space equal sign space multi underscore key close quote. And the multi underscore key has a capital M and everything else was lowercase. Okay, so this special magical modifying key is called a multi key. So that the whole command again is xmod map space dash e space quote key code 135 equals multi underscore key close quote with a capital M on the multi key. And that basically defines for our current environment, for the session that we are in right now, that whenever I send a key code 135 to the OS, I want it to interpret that key code as something called a multi-key. Okay, well, what is a multi-key? Well, it's exactly the key that I had on Mac OS, for instance. I had modifier key was the option key for me. Now it's the multi-key. So if I hit the multi-key, or the menu key, and then let's say an apostrophe, the key right next to the return key, multi-key apostrophe, that puts me into what's called a dead letter mode, which means that I pressed something and now it's waiting for me to give it the next letter so that it can do something with that letter. So if I hit multi-key apostrophe and then the letter I, for instance, it will give me the letter I with a little accent mark over it. If I hit the multi-key and the letter S in the dead letter mode and now I hit S again, I get the funky B from the German language. It looks like it's a capital B, but it's really pronounced like a double S. And there's all kinds of different combinations. I mean, it just depends on what you need and what you find yourself requiring for, you know, whatever you're writing. Well, now, obviously that only does you a little bit of good, depending on whether or not you know these magical key combinations, right? So if you don't know, if you know what you want and don't know how to get it, or you don't know what you want to see what's available to you, there is a file on your system right now that will tell you exactly all these special keyboard mappings. And you could modify it yourself if you wanted to as well. I don't. I look in this file and see what the correct combination is, because I figure that way it'll be the same on any Linux box I sit down in front of, and I don't use these things frequently enough to want to change anything. But the best way to do this is to grep multi-key. So you type in grep space multi underscore key capital M space slash usr slash share slash x11, that's with a capital X, slash locale slash en underscore us dot utf-8, and that's all capitalized except the en, slash compose with a capital C, and you pipe that to less so that you can actually see it without it flying by your screen. So we just basically grepped for the word multi-key in this file in user share x11 slash en whatever. And this is all posted on a site that I wrote up a little tutorial on it, so I will link to that so that you can actually see that command, because it's a pretty long path and I don't really want to try to spell it out and stuff. But you grep multi-key in that file, and it lists everything available to you when you hit the multi-key, and it's a long list, so you might want to even export it or something to some kind of easily, you know, something that you can maybe cut down into a size of, so that it contains the key codes that you're actually interested in or something like that, you know, just depending on whether you're going to use it as a cheat sheet or whether you just need it really quick one time for a reference or whatever. But that's where all that stuff is, that's where it's all determined, so that's obviously good to know about. So you got it now, that's it, multi-key and then some other letter or some other letter and some other letter, and that's what you do. That's how you get these alternate characters from your otherwise American keyboard or anything. I mean, obviously there's going to be alternate keyboards no matter what the layout of your keyboard is, and that's how you do it. Now, the other part of this is going to be getting this to persist across sessions, right? Because otherwise you're going to have to run that xmod map every time you log in. That's no fun. So the way to get this to actually, I mean, after you see it working and everything like that, the way to get it to happen every single time is to create a .xmodmap file in your home folder. The strange thing about this is that it's a .xmodmap with a capital X in this case. I know the command was xmodmap all lowercase. The configuration file or the RC file or whatever, it's actually .capital capital X and then mod map all lowercase. This means that whenever you log in, you start X, it's going to look into your home folder and look for certain configuration files, right? Like your .bashrc or your .bash underscore profile or .gconf or .kde all those kinds of special dot files that live in your home directory, this will now become one of them, .xmodmap. And all you do in xmodmap is you put the same, essentially the same command. So you just put key code 135 equals multi-key. So what I did was I just, after I confirmed that it was working, I went back into my history in bash, found my xmodmap-e quote key code 135 equals multi-key, end quote, and I just said, okay, echo everything in that quote. So I echo, quote, key code 135 equals multi-key, end quote, into, so greater than, dot capital X mod map. And that echoed that statement into dot X mod map. It actually created the file since it didn't exist previously, but I wasn't sure, so I didn't want to write over anything important. And then you can log out and walk away from your computer, log back in. It will still do your multi-key magic. You can turn off your computer and go to sleep and get up in the morning and turn it back on and log in, and it will still do the mod map multi-key trick. So that's getting it to persist. It should pretty much work without too much of an issue. Okay, so that was how to do alternate characters on your keyboard. Not a big deal. Pretty easy, actually. It's just a question of finding out how to do it, right? Interestingly, this kind of made me start thinking about Linux support. And the idea of Linux support has always been kind of this weird, confused area of like, well, what exactly should Linux support be? Is it reliable? Can we count on it? Can we advertise it? How, you know, what is Linux support? And Linux support, traditionally, I think among a lot of Linux users it's just IRC and forums and things like that, right? And the community is very, very helpful. And there's always kind of this trump card up every Linux geek's sleeve, because whenever someone says, well, I can't rely on that, I can't make a business around that, whatever, then they say, well, yeah, you can also buy support from this company, from Red Hat, or from this company, from Canonical, or from, you know, this other company. You just, whatever company out there today is offering paid Linux support. And I think that's a very, very valid option. But I was thinking about Linux support, and it's got kind of this kind of weird history to it, right? And a lot of people say, oh, well, Linux support used to be horrible, and it still is sometimes, because you ask a question and people just say RTFM, meaning read the manual, and it's not friendly. And while, generally speaking, the reputation, I think, has gotten a lot better, and people know that they don't have to fear asking questions or anything like that, and that they're not going to get yelled at for not knowing something, I think that it's something to think about, that sometimes Linux support is, it's almost either too helpful or helpful in the wrong way. And by this, I mean just sign into an IRC channel, or sign into a forum and ask a question. On the right forum, you'll get an answer quickly. You'll get a simple answer, or it might be complex, but it will be simply stated, and it will work, and that'll be the end of the story. On the right IRC channel, like the official Fedora channel or the official Ubuntu channel, things like that. In those kinds of channels, hopefully you're going to get one answer that will solve your problem right now, and then you can walk away and not think about it ever again. In the wrong places, however, and I'm sure you've seen this, and if you haven't, just be on the lookout for it. You will ask a question. It will be a simple question, and instead of getting one clear, correct answer, you will get six different ways of almost doing the thing that you're trying to do. And it's kind of this weird complex or mentality of a group getting together and trying to help the same person at the same time, every person wanting to suggest something different for some reason. I don't know why exactly that is, but I've seen it happen. And people will suggest something different. Different people will chime in. The first person to answer will have it right, but then the next person to answer will point out why that's not the most efficient way of doing the thing, of solving the problem. And then someone else will chime in and say, well, the official way of doing it, rather than either efficient or whatever, would be to do such and such. And then someone chime in and explain why that wouldn't work, because the library required for that activity is undergoing heavy development right now and is not supported by some other library or some, you know, it's just, it gets into this big mess and like this big technical debate, and meanwhile no one remembers that some noob is off in the corner crying because he can't get onto the get his wireless working, or he can't partition a disk or format a disk, can't figure out how to use MKFS, you know, whatever the problem might be. And this is, I think, a real good case for something that we could call sort of a, instead of RTFM, we could have like maybe an IKBCE, I know but can't explain, which would be that, yes, you've got 10 gurus or self-appointed gurus and maybe one real guru in an IRC channel, but that doesn't mean everyone should be giving, I guess, support, or if they're going to give support, they should do it in such a way that it's actually pointed toward helping the person asking the question. And the reason this made me think of it was because I myself have asked many times how to use XModMap, or how to remap such and such a key, or how to get those alternate characters on my keyboard, and rather than getting the answer that I just gave you, dear listener, I would get all kinds of interesting, oh, well, you'll want to use XModMap. So you'll go, you'll be the dutiful noob, and you'll go read the XModMap man page, right? And not all man pages are written equally, and sometimes even if they are well written, you don't necessarily have the context to fully understand what you're reading. So you might have to come back and say, okay, well, I've got XModMap. As I understand it, I need to make a .xmodmap file, correct? And rather than answering your question, they will give you an alternate way of doing it. Actually, the better way to do it would be go into /usr/share/x11 and change your character set on your keyboard. You know, all these weird, like, alternate and probably correct ways of doing something, but there's a hypothetical question of, what are the many different ways in Linux that I can do X, or foobar, and versus what is one way that I can get foobar done and move on with my life? And a lot of people don't seem to be able to do the to give the latter kind of answer, which leads me to think that, yes, maybe we do need something that says, yes, I'm a guru, yes, I'm smart, yes, I know everything about Linux, so I can't explain to you how to do what you're asking. I know how to do it. I know every possible way of doing it, but I am not a good communicator for answers. So please, don't ask me, or go ask someone else. It wouldn't be an RTFM answer. It would simply be a, really, I'm smart, I know the answer, but I just can't tell you because I'm not that kind of, support person. And I think you tend, to be fair, I think you tend to see this kind of issue in non-support channels, places that do not advertise themselves as support channels, which is why I think probably when someone does say, like, why don't you go ask that question over in Fedora, or why don't you go ask that question over in, I don't know, Slackware, or, you know, the whatever forum, the official channel, it shouldn't be taken to mean, I hope, by people that they don't want to answer, they're being bugged by you. It just means that you're not asking in the appropriate channel. Another variation, I think, of this, and I'm sure I've been guilty of this, is where the noob himself or herself is asking the sort of the wrong question. You know, I mean, if I popped into a channel and said, how do I modify my keyboard to give me foreign characters? Well, to me, that makes perfect sense. I want to have my American keyboard make what are foreign characters to me. But what if I just accidentally asked some guy from France and I didn't realize he was from France? To him, a foreign character is an American, you know, the American stuff, or a Japanese stuff. Maybe am I asking him how to change my French keyboard to American keyboard layout? Or, you know, what exactly am I asking? So I think there's a burden there of on the noob of asking the right question as well. The point being that I think we should be aware of this sort of issue. But if you're good with support, if you're good with that kind of thing, I guess I'm urging you in a way to make that known. You know, just do that sometimes if you like a challenge and you want to help a noob figure out their wireless card or how to install graphic driver that they need or whatever. And if you're not, I urge you, I guess, to recognize that you're not and actually tell people, hey, look, I'm really smart and I can tell you how to cross compile. And set your C flags, and I can tell you how to do all this other stuff, but I'm really bad at explaining it. Don't take offense, but I can't explain it very well. Something like that, and that way you're not taking up everyone's time, you're not bragging about how great you are at obscure Unix tricks, while really all someone wants to do is figure out how to, you know, where the logout button is on GNOME. So that's my thoughts on the subject. Okay, it's time for a cup of coffee for sure. It's cold out here. I gotta get a really nice hot cup of coffee. So grab yourself a cup of coffee and we'll come back together and take some listener feedback. Okay, that was some great coffee, and now I'm back. I'm a bit warmer, ready to take some listener feedback. The first one I've got is actually not an email. It was a conversation I had in IRC with Cobra 2, who you will know as the administrator or one of the site administrators for UnixPorn.com. Remember, it's not porn, it's Unix. And he and I were talking, and it turns out that, well, another listener feedback, which you'll hear in a moment or experience in a moment, is saying that I get some server space. Someone's donating some server space to me, but I won't continue too much. So anyway, the point is that something there are ads on a lot of sites, especially my sites, because I never pay for hosting. I always get like the free hosting deal from GoDaddy. I pay like $2 for the domain name and then just settle for their little free hosting account and do everything from there. Now, I figure 9 people out of 10 of the people who care about any of my sites are, have like Adblock Plus on their Firefox or whatever. So I figure it's not a big deal that there are ads because no one's going to see them anyway. And I think that's probably true. But here's a nifty trick that Cobra 2 reminded me of. Apparently I've mentioned this before. I really don't remember mentioning this ever. But what he did was he went into /etsy/hosts. I mean, I remember talking about /etsy/hosts at one point, but I don't remember doing this trick. But anyway, go into /etsy/hosts as root and set an IP address such as 127.0.0.1 and make it resolve to, or rather, make the domain name that you want to block resolve to that, i.e., the ads on my sites all come from this place called a12alphagodaddy.com, or something weird like that. If you set 127.0.0.12 to the site of a12.alphagodaddy.com, or whatever it is, then when you go to a site with these ads, when the browser looks to find out what A12 is, because it sees on the code, right on the page code, oh, I'm supposed to insert a portion of A12.alphagodaddy.com here. So when it goes out to look for that, before it gets out there into the DNS of the whole interwebs and figures out where to go get A12.alphagodaddy, it gets intercepted by our /etsy/hosts. And says, oh, it resolves that site is actually this very computer, this 127.0.0.1. That's your local host. So unless you have a whole repository of advertisements on your computer from which it can draw with the same paths as that of a12.godaddy.com, then it's not going to find anything, and it just leaves everything there blank. So it doesn't even take up any space. It's like intercepting it and sending it to dev null in a way. Now, I did a variation on this because I was a little bit nervous at setting something at 127.0.0.1, because that's localhost, you know? I mean, I don't know. For some reason, it feels weird defining that to random ads, not as a security thing, but just as a functionality thing. Like, I don't know, it just feels weird to set your localhost to resolve to, or something to resolve to your localhost. So I just gave it like a totally random IP address, a local like IP address that I don't use. So that's what I did, but I'm sure it's fine to do 127.0.0.1. And if it's not, I'm sure Ken Fallon will probably correct me. Oh, speaking of Ken Fallon, Ken Fallon wrote me and said, hey, why don't you put some information on a server of mine? And so he just basically offered some server space for like a show or two. And that was much appreciated, and I figured probably the thing that would really deserve some server space is Unix Porn, because that site is actually, I mean, I get people signing into that site and posting pictures I've never heard from before. I have no idea who they are, where they come from, how they knew about the site, so it's really cool, and I figure something that seems to be used by probably more people than, for instance, listen to any of my shows, I figure that should probably have no ads on it. It should look attractive. I mean, it's not that the ads are that bug me that much, but the problem is they start popping up in like little frames, you know, when you're trying to upload your file and stuff. They just really get in the way. So I figured, okay, Unix Porn deserves its own server, so I'm going to be porting eventually all my stuff over to Ken Fallon's server, or Ken Fallon's friend's server, or something like that, but it's much, much, much appreciated, and I'm really excited to port that over. Let's see, what else? Ken Fallon also wrote and said that I could have server space for, I think, another site, and I think I said I would move something over to it. I don't really remember. Deep Geek actually wrote me and said that he wouldn't mind hosting slackermedia.info. I might have mentioned this already, but slackermedia.info now, if you do like a host slackermedia.info, you will see eventually that it will, it actually lives on slackermedia.deepgeek.us, so That was really cool of him to do that, because I didn't really want ads on that site either, because I really do, I want that to be a resource for everyone in terms of, like, understanding how to configure Linux for multimedia and stuff like that. The Last Known God wrote me. The Last Known God you'll possibly recognize from the old Linux Reality forums. He was a forum admin over there, if I recall correctly. But I met him at OLF, and he's a nice guy, a swell guy, in fact. And he wrote me, and he said that he really enjoyed the Fluxbox episode that I did, which I think was just this past one, right? And he said that there's a cool sort of workaround, or something even better than fbsetbg, which is the command that I run in my Fluxbox startup file, so .fluxbox/startup, to set my background. Apparently what fbsetupbg is a front end to is a little program called Feh, F-E-H. And this seems to be a really cool program. I mean, it seems to be able to just do all kinds of cool things. It's kind of almost, it strikes me almost as like a simplified image magic or a visual Sox, if you will. And it does a lot of stuff, and one of the things that it can do is set a background in Fluxbox. So you can actually just put, you can use Feh, F-E-H, to set your background with the command Feh, F-E-H, or Feh, F-E-H, space, dash, dash, B-G, dash, center, space, and then the path to your image. And that will, right then and there, just from that terminal, it will set the background image on your desktop, and then exit. Now, what it also does in the background is it kind of logs that file. It says, okay, the last background we used was this image, you know, the path to that image. So, it knows that from now on in its .fehrc file or something like that. And now, in your startup file, instead of putting fbg set or fbsetbg, you simply put eval space single quote cat space /.fehbg end single quote and then the ampersand sign to end, you know, to send that to the background. So it basically runs the little feh command on whatever's in .fehbg, so that every time you start up Fluxbox, it looks at whatever the last wallpaper was, and it makes it that wallpaper again, which is kind of nice, because if you're just sitting around one day and suddenly get the notion that you want to change your background, you can just run Feh manually, change your background, and then the next time you log on, it will still be that background. So that is kind of nice. I find, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I find that Fluxbox, just for me, it works a lot better if I install it manually. I just don't like the Fluxbox that I get from distributions, and I could be wrong about this. It could be totally in my head, but I have found that both on Ubuntu and Fedora, Fluxbox, it seems like there are little glitches here and there in the way that, just simple things, like unimportant stuff, like setting the background or something. And I haven't done this in a while, but I recall having to go in and, like, modifying some stuff that they were kind of doing that would actually override my personal settings. And that really annoys me. So I could be wrong about this. It could just be me remembering it incorrectly or something, or me not understanding something correctly. But if you do experience any weirdness on setting backgrounds or from the startup file, find your configuration file basically and see what they're having it do. Because I know Ubuntu had one where it was setting my background to like a Debian blue swirl or something like that, but it wasn't the right resolution for the monitor, so it kept giving me this weird error and doing weird things. And then I think in Fedora's Fluxbox, I tried it and I couldn't get it to set my background persistently. I could set it and then it would go away or something. I forget exactly what it is, and it could just be the theme files that I'm using. Who knows? But just if that is happening, either try your hand at just installing plain vanilla Fluxbox yourself, or just switch to Slackware. That would be my advice, I guess. Not really, of course, but yeah, just try either installing it yourself or poke around for some kind of global configuration file, or take a look at your theme file. Let me know if you figure it out, because, like I say, it's a vague memory that I have that I had trouble. I could be remembering it incorrectly. So Ken Fallon wrote me one recently and was talking about this thing with Speaks Encoder, and he and I went back and forth on what was going on, why he wasn't able to encode something as Speaks. And it turns out that interestingly, Speaks Encoder has a very specific set of sample rates that it wants to encode from. It will attempt to encode from other sample rates, but it really has a set that it prefers, and I don't remember off the top of my head which set that is. I want to say it is 8, 16, and 22, with a possible correction that it might be 8, 22, and 32. It's some of those lower sample rates, and if you don't have that correct sample rate, your mileage is going to vary in terms of whether or not it can encode your file. It's going to vary whether or not it does the encoding as well as it, I guess, it could or should be able to. The way to set this in Audacity is actually in the lower left-hand corner, at least the way I have it configured. Lower left-hand corner, there's a sample rate box. And it is, by default, this box sets itself to whatever the first sample rate, whatever file you first import into Audacity, that becomes the project sample rate. So on my show, The Bad Apples, I record everything on my Nokia, right? It records at 8,000 hertz, or 8 kilohertz. If I import a vocal track first, then Audacity sets the project sample rate to 8 kilohertz, or 8,000 hertz. And then I import music, which was recorded at 44,100, or 44.1 kilohertz. I import that, and it down samples it to 8 kilohertz. Big difference, right? Now, if I imported the music track first, then the project rate becomes 44.1 kilohertz. And when I import my vocal track, it gets upsampled to 44.1. So obviously, in one case, the lower sample rate is getting upconverted to something better, and in the other case, the higher sample rate is getting downsampled to something much, much lower. You want to be mindful of this for that extreme example, I mean, extreme real-life example. That kind of case, you would really want to, I mean, what if you didn't want your music to be at 8 kilohertz? You know, I mean, it's a big difference. One is CD quality, 44.1 is CD quality, and 8 is, I don't even know what kind of quality they consider that. It's like VoIP quality or something. You know, it's really, really low quality. So after you edit your thing or you do whatever you're doing in Audacity, you can go down to that little box and set the project sample rate to whatever you want. And if you know you're going to, you know, you're going to export this as Speaks after you export it from Audacity, if you're going to convert it to Speaks, you can set it to something Speaks friendly, like 16 kilohertz. Or 16,000 hertz. And then you go to export, and then you export it as a WAV file or whatever you want to export it as. I'd probably go out as either WAV or FLAC. And I just go out as WAV, let's put it that way. I don't want to tell you FLAC and then have Speaks Encode not work with FLAC for some weird reason. So export it as WAV at 16,000 hertz or whatever. It exports the WAV file, and it doesn't really make any mention of the sample rate. You know, it just says, okay, I'm exporting as WAV now, but you have set the sample rate of the project in that little drop-down menu box on the lower left-hand corner of Audacity, so whether you realize it or not, it's working. And then you can go into Speaks ENC, Speaks Encoder, and issue the command to encode it. And the command I've been using lately is just speaks ENC, I think it's space dash Q, dash dash Q, no, dash dash quality, or dash Q, space, you know, 0 or 1 or 2, whatever quality you think you need, and then the input file and then the output file, where the input file would be the bad apples 504.wav, and the output would be the bad apples 504.spx. And that is how you do that. Now, what's really neat is that Ken came up with this interesting command and actually kind of made a little discovery about Speaks ENC, that it's actually a, I guess you could call it a processor. There's probably some kind of very fancy term for it, but you can actually pipe stuff into it. So what he was doing was, I guess he was recording like a voice memo on some kind of Sansa device. So he did socks space slash media slash Sansa slash recording slash voice slash, you know, voice memo dot wave, dash T wave, W-A-V, so that would be the type is wave. The sample rate, dash R is 16K for 16 kilohertz, dash, and then the pipe, and then speaks ENC, dash, recording dot SPX. And that actually takes the file of, you know, the WAV file from the Sansa. It makes sure that it keeps it to the in the type of, you know, as a WAV file at a sample rate of 16 kilohertz, pipes that into Speaks Encode, and spits it back out as recording .spx. So that's a really, really cool command. I had no idea Speaks was a pipeable, you know, thing like that. So he found that out, let me know about it, and I think that's pretty cool. So you can actually process stuff through it rather than just, you know, utilize it as something to affect something after the fact. You can actually pipe stuff right through it, which makes it very flexible for interesting commands, I'm sure. Okay, one more very, very quick listener feedback, and then I'm going to wrap up the show, I think. Jane from France wrote me, and she says that, she sent me this blog post from some person somewhere, and he was reviewing the Triple E PC after having had it for 2 years, which I thought was a pretty interesting review. You know, I mean, the Triple E PC made big enough news pretty much everywhere, I think we'll all agree, but in the Linux community, that it is kind of interesting to go back and revisit, okay, well, how has the Triple E PC performed after 2 years of being on the market and in people's hands? And so I read the blog post, and the person was actually, you know, really happy with everything, didn't have a problem with anything, seemed to think that everything was really great. And I kept reading, and the more I read, the more appalled I became. I mean, issues like, and this person was completely happy about it, but they were having issues like parts from the inside, little plastic pieces from the inside of the computer chipping off and lodging into the fan. No problem, it was a quick fix. The keyboard no longer working, like just getting pounded away, I guess, and just not working anymore. No problem, there's a replacement keyboard for fairly cheap. The buttons on the touchpad don't work anymore. No problem, it was an easy fix. Or actually, that might have been one of the bigger problems that there was no easy fix for, like a replacement part or something. The sound no longer works. No sound on the Triple EP, on this person's Triple EPC. I mean, it was a positive review, and yet it was like it sounds like this thing must have been, I don't know what they did to their Triple EPC, and you can tell me if I'm crazy here, but for a laptop to only last 2 years, and I don't care what you spent on it. I mean, I think they said that it was a $400 laptop when they bought a 400 price range, and they didn't say whether this was the 7, I guess that must have been the 7-inch, right, because that was, or maybe the 9-inch was out 2 years ago, I don't really remember, but yeah, so you've got like this this little netbook, and you bought it for $400, and it's, I mean, in my book, that's practically a dead laptop. I mean, the keyboard doesn't work correctly, the touchpad doesn't work correctly, and the sound is gone. I don't care how happy they are with that. That's horrible. And things are chipping off from the inside and lodging into the fans. I mean, that's horrible. It's terrible. And I don't know what they're doing to their laptop to make this occur. Now, conversely, I've had my Triple E PC for probably about 2 years, and I mean, the thing has gone across country with me at least twice, up the California coast once, it's gone to festivals, multiple Linux festivals, and other technical events, bar camps and stuff like that. I've been homeless with it once for about a month. Granted, I wasn't sleeping under a bridge or anything, but I mean, it wasn't exactly in a temperature-controlled room in my house with a, you know, on a velvet pillow or suspended with force fields or something. I mean, it's been through its fair share of outings. It's been, you know, obviously just at cafes and libraries with me to work and back. Just it's been put through what I would call normal to aggressive laptop use, and so far it's been great. So I don't know if I'm just treating my laptops better than other people, or if they just had really, really bad luck, and apparently he has two. He has one for him and one for his wife, so it means it's two Triple E PCs that he's reviewing, and both of them are pretty badly broken in my book. And it's either that these people are treating their laptops a lot rougher than I ever do, or our standards have gone really, really down, and for anyone to think that after 2 years it's okay for their laptop to just completely fall apart, I don't know, that sounds extreme to me. And you can, like I say, I mean, let me know if I'm crazy here, but that really does sound pretty dismal to me. I mean, if laptops are only going to last for 2 years now, wow, that's going to be a frightening place to live. So I'm hoping that they're just very extreme, and that I'm not the only one with a Triple EPC that's in great condition still. And I hope that people require a little bit more sturdiness and quality from the things that they're purchasing, especially things that are using up all kinds of resources. You know, it's plastic and whatever chemicals go into all these different parts of the computers. We have to make them last a little bit longer than 2 years, you know? So hopefully that's a fluke. And like I say, it's a pretty bizarre blog post because he seems perfectly happy with it. He's like, oh, it's fine. 2 years for a $400 laptop, that's about normal for me. I'm just like, what? I mean, he better have been, I don't know, to Australia or something with it, where, you know, they're not civilized there, so that might be something, but yeah, that's crazy. So that was just my thought, and that's my thought. And that's the show, in fact. So that was episode 4 of season 5. My name is Klaatu, and my contact information is klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. Also find me on Freenode, ircfreenode.net, irc.freenode.net, in the channels Linux Cranks or Linux, a lot of Linux links, or Slacker Media or Slackware, other channels from time to time. So, say hi if you see me, and that's about it. So thanks for listening.